The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Let's get going and talk about Nomad. And in the book, you make the case, after you discuss your family, that a lot of what you're talking about is Islam and its relationship to the issues of sex, debt, and violence, and how it doesn't really set people up to move into modernity. And I would imagine as people read it, they might say, well, sex, until recently, our society, Western society, was very conservative on the issue. And debt and violence, as I read many of the chapters, I thought, is this an issue of religion or an issue of poverty and lack of education? People really don't know how to handle their money or how to interact. They go to the more basic instincts. Why is this so much to you about Islam and what it does to people?
Islam was born in a culture and in a context. And in that culture was Arab, and it was nomadic, and it was patriarchal, and it was a desert culture. And Islam was founded in the 7th century. And given the society of that time, and the idea of a tribe, clan, collectives, and the mechanisms that governed it, shame and honor, it is very, very difficult to say we're going to separate the theology from and the way it's practiced and the prescriptions that it affords people from what we would call culture. In fact, when I address audiences like you these days, just to make sure that I'm not the only one who says religion is born out of culture, and culture and religion are intertwined, I always ask members of the audience, put up your hand if you think that the two can be completely separated. Put up your hand if you think that culture and religion are indeed intertwined. So I'm not the only one, fortunately. I'm not mad. So given that background, having grown up as a Muslim, having observed Muslim communities in Europe, having gone through the whole debate and the dilemma of how do you assimilate Muslim immigrants into European society, what part does culture play? Is poverty an outcome of culture and religion, or is it poverty that causes people to flee to religion, and how does that interplay with one another? I just relate my own story in Nomad, where I say I'm fascinated by how Europeans first and then Americans, these stories, how people about 50, sometimes 100 years ago were not very different from their attitudes were not very different from my mother's. What happened? And when I arrive at these universal themes of sex, money, and violence, what I see is people who have embraced modernity, whether they are black or white, whether they are Western or non-Western, have adopted different ideas from the ones that I grew up with around sexuality, around violence, and around aggression. That's what I describe in the book. And Islamic teachers, Islamic preachers, and Islamic theology tells us to go about our sexuality in a certain way. It mystifies it, stresses virginity, confines women to a position that is not compatible with modern life. Aggression is used as a method for the collective to suppress the individual, as a measure of punishment. Money is not something that is earned and saved and invested and so on, but it's something that's given to you by God and that you should share with others. And when you run into debt, then you have to ask help from the clan, and the clan is obligated to do that by God. So I describe these differences, and I think that for Muslims, it's better if they shared those values that govern money, sexuality, and aggression give them up and adopt the new values of the West. They've been called of the West, but modern values, whatever you like to call them, yeah.
In the book, you talk about Enlightenment values and why that's a better value system to put forward. But when you think about the Enlightenment before it was the Dark Ages and religion and the way it clamped down on thinking and on behavior and how many scientists and thinkers struggled through that time, do you think that there's a chance that Islam could be going through its own transformation? It may be a few steps behind what Christianity went through, but it is transforming, or you think it is stuck in one place?
Muslims are transforming, and they're transforming at a rapid pace because Muslims, for many of them, it's a fast time to be in the diaspora. Most Muslims, not all of them, most Muslims have lived in places where they are the majority and where they deal the cards. It's a very fast time for Muslims in a long time in their history to be in a place where someone else, another community tells them to integrate or assimilate into them. Enlightenment for me means nothing else than that you, as a human being, as an individual, make use of your reason, your brains, that you ask questions, that you experiment, that you learn through trial and error, and if through many errors a certain practice has been proved to be not viable, wrong, inhumane, that you give that up. So enlightenment is an attitude of learning. It is an attitude whereby you change your mind if the facts change. You don't accept any assertion as being the truth unless there is evidence for it. Christians have been exposed to that kind of a mindset, and Christian theology and Christian history, as I've found it in the Netherlands and in the United States, has been questioned over and over and over again. And most Christians in the West seem to me to have given up old ideas when those ideas were proven to be impracticable or violent violate human rights. Muslims in the West, the more we question and the more we ask them and demand of them to use their reason, will also evolve. My problem with the debate on Islam today is, on the one hand, that a number of Muslims are demanding not to be asked the questions, and a number of Westerners, especially liberals, are saying, let's not ask them the question, let's exempt them from critical scrutiny. That, in my vision, is the problem of today with regard to examining and scrutinizing Islam.
You talk a lot about the youth in Western cultures, Islamic youth who come to Europe and to America, and why they don't become part of the whole, they don't assimilate. Whenever we have news events, something has blown up, something has gone on, they go into these communities and they say, what happened? And the answer is never, we were radicalized by Islam. It is, we turned to Islam because we were shut out elsewhere. We couldn't get a job. We weren't accepted. We were pushed out of the hole. So is the blame in these cases for radicalization solely Islam, or is some of this back on Western culture, or I should say Western societies?
So it's the argument of persecution. I'm not going to assimilate. I'm not going to find a job. I'm going to be violent. I'm going to become a member of a jihadi movement because you don't accept me. There's something wrong with that argument, because I've been marginalized, because I'm not accepted by my classmates, by my neighbors, by my employers, etc. I think that is not just a very weird argument, but I think it's also an implausible argument. I'll tell you why it's implausible. Throughout human history, people who are persecuted leave the places where they are persecuted. You remember the history of the Jews in Europe. They were persecuted, they were marginalized, they were put in ghettos. They had stars fixed to their shoulders, they were gassed, they were remarkably discriminated against. What did the Jews do? They organized, those of them who survived, and they left. They went elsewhere. Think of the Tutsis in Rwanda, when they were persecuted, most of them went on an exodus. They left. Think of the people in Afghanistan, the most internally displaced people in the world, between, I think, the 1980s and the 1990s came from Afghanistan. There was persecution, so people packed their bags and left. What I find remarkable about the claim made by some Muslims in the West that they are persecuted against and disenfranchised, etc., is that there are more Muslims flowing into the West. They're coming from Muslim countries. They're demanding for themselves a special treatment that no one else has. Muslims are not packing their bags and they're not leaving America. They're not leaving Europe. They are flowing into Europe. That argument that they are disenfranchised against does not carry weight. There's no empirical evidence for it. I have lived in Europe. I've served in government. I know the amount of money that got given by the taxpayer that is spent on the Muslim child to keep him on school, to stimulate the Muslim mother to go to swimming classes, to stimulate the Muslim father to spend time with his money, with his parents, to integrate them into Western society. Given that, I think what we need to do is explore why people feel persecuted and why there is this discrepancy between the empirical, people are helped and welcomed, and the way they perceive that help as persecution. And what you will find, and what I have found, is there is propaganda directed toward these Muslim communities that are vulnerable. And that propaganda that is directed at them is to reject the West, to see themselves as victims. They are told Islam is under siege. They hear that through satellite dishes, through the television, online, in papers, from imams. And it's that narrative that we have to explore and compete with and offer something else in return. But I don't think we should give in to the accusation that Muslims in the West are persecuted against, because there is no evidence for that.
That's a look at Muslims in the West. For Muslims in Muslim countries, there were certain nations, Egypt, Turkey come to mind, where people saw a more liberal strain coming about, more freedoms for women, different attitude. And then in recent years, there seemed to be a more traditional attitude takeover. Why? I think people look at that and wonder, why would somebody in Turkey want to go in that direction rather than enjoying the freedoms?
In Turkey, in Egypt, even in places like Syria and Morocco, Tunisia, places like Somalia, the interesting thing is you'll find that these places were more modern in the 1950s and the 1960s than in the 1990s. And a lot of experts, a lot of journalists, a lot of investigators have gone back and looked what happened, what went wrong. And what you see is that there is a discourse paid for with oil money in Arab Muslim countries, places as far as Pakistan and Malaysia and Indonesia, where there is the Muslim Brotherhood movement with a message: we have to go back to a time when we can practice pure Islam, follow the Prophet Muhammad in his footsteps. Some people call it Salafis or Salafism. Whatever you call it, whatever you decide to call it, that purist movement has gone from being a grassroots, I don't want to compare them with the Tea Party, but it was a grassroots movement, and in the beginning it was dismissed as being abnormal, anti-Islamic even, and not one of us. It was considered to be Saudi, it was considered to be alien. And so the leadership of all of these countries ignored it, and later when these groups became large enough to topple them, they were accommodated. And that accommodation did not stop any of these Islamist movements from becoming more successful, because the more they were appeased, the more demands that they made. They became successful in a context of societies, Muslim societies, ruled by despots. There are hardly any democratic countries that are Muslim. Indonesia and Turkey were the exception, but they're becoming even more corrupt or more despotic in a sense. So these grassroots movements, based on Islam and pure Islam, offer a narrative for life that explains the difference between right and wrong, and more people are subscribing to it. And Westerners have themselves been very ignorant of it when they found out about it, complacent to it, even when it has taken root in Western soil, in American soil, in European soil. So that is where it comes from, and it's inspired by Islam. These people are carrying the Quran as their holy book, and they mention Muhammad as their leader. And I think what we need to do is study that content, introduce a different content, a counter message, and then appeal to the hearts and minds of Muslims and say, there is a better way that you can lead your life and abandon jihadism. And that's exactly what we are now doing.
In the book, you talk about the role of governments, the role of the Catholic Church or other churches, and you also have a passage of two friends sitting on a bench and what one girl might say to another. When you talk about this culture clash and trying to change the mind of people who are Muslim, do you see that as a role for governments, or do you think individuals should be going to their Muslim friends and challenging them on their beliefs?
I think that individuals should be going to their Muslim friends, and if they don't have Muslim friends, should be making Muslim friends and going to them and trying to engage them, trying to find out what this content is. I think that Westerners have been put on the defensive, and on a defensive that the only way we can think about combating jihadism is only by military means or by ethnic profiling, or secret services should be spying on people, reading their emails, stuff like that. But what do we ordinary citizens do about it? And what we ordinary citizens do about this is pick up on the marketplace of ideas. Islamism is an idea like any other idea. It is a ferocious idea. We don't like it. Some people like it and find it appealing and act on it. And it's those people who are targeted whom we need, as if they are part of a cult, to go to and persuade them to have a different idea. If you put all your eggs in the basket of, we can deport them anyway, or we're going to profile them, or we're going to nuke them, I think we'll be defeated because we are not going to do any of that. And why are we not going to do any of that? Because as humane, open, free societies, we don't deal with people like that. We simply don't kill people whose ideas we don't like, and we don't want to do that. That is what makes America superior to Saudi Arabia. That's what makes America superior to Iran. Americans do not kill the people whose ideas they don't like, but they give them an alternative idea. And the weak link here, the weakness that I see, and that inspired me to answer that question about what should we be doing, is we are not competing in the realm of ideas. We're exempting Islam from proper scrutiny. If we are critical of Islam, we are told that we are Islamophobes and we are racist. We are not. We are not prejudiced. Again, Muslims in the West are not persecuted. If they were, they wouldn't be coming in large numbers, and the ones here would be leaving. So it's not true. It's just a matter of perception. And we have to compete with the people who are spreading that perception and offer those vulnerable communities who have fled their lands in search of a better life. We've got to offer them alternative value systems that make it possible for them to attain that better life.
I'm sure you have multiple times heard of the criticism of, well, isn't this trying to say, to compare Islam to a cult, isn't there a strain? Aren't there people who practice it in a way that lives alongside reason, that allows them to be peaceful? I can think of friends of mine who are practicing Muslims, very much academics, involved in day-to-day life, embracing ideas, very peaceful people. Is there not a place for that sort of Muslim without saying, you should be converted or this is the wrong way?
There has always been a place for Muslims like those, and even Muslims who are more fundamentalist and want things in a different way. I mean, in the United States of America, there are organized groups lobbying for Sharia, and there's a place for them. That's not the point. I think we are being distracted by continually having to put ourselves on the defensive. But they are nice Muslims. I know my neighbor and I know my friend. I have tons of friends. And my starting point is that people born into Islam, like all other people, are generally peace-loving. And they generally want life like we want to. They just want to have to send their kids to school and lead their lives. But they are targeted by Islamists who use the Quran and the example of Muhammad, Islamic scripture, and Islamic scholarship to persuade those friends of yours to feel that they're persecuted. And because Islam is under siege, to distance themselves from the non-Muslim or convert him. The guy who tried to blow up Times Square, Faisal Shahzad, looked to me, when I saw his pictures, very ordinary. And when I read his profile, he was living the American dream. He came into this country by applying for a student visa and got it. And then he went to university, did business school, found a job, found a wife here. He was leading a wonderful life that many Americans want to lead. What is it that got to him? Why did he give up his job? Why did he go to Pakistan to train to become a jihadist? He was middle class. He wasn't persecuted. He was living the American dream. What happened? Who got to him? What is the idea that he adopted? And how does Islam relate to that? We should compete for the hearts and minds of potential Faisal Shahzads so that they don't choose to go to Pakistan and train for terrorism, so that they choose to continue the life that he had come for in the first place. Perhaps it's not our responsibility. I mean, I can shrug my shoulders about it and say, well, you know, one of us becomes a liberal, the other one becomes a libertarian, the other one becomes a Christian, the other one becomes a jihadi. What the hell? We can do that. But it took only 19 men to plunge the world into war, to plunge America into two wars. Only 19 men. So don't ever dismiss. When people say it's a fringe group, it's a minority, etc., think of it. It was only 19 men. And if you can convince 19 men to give up their lives, hijack airplanes, fly them into tall towers, and you know how potent and powerful that message is, then I think it is time now to find out why. How is that inspired and why does it get into it? And the chapter, Opening the Muslim Mind, I'm trying to answer that question. I'm not even trying to answer it. I'm just trying to address it.
But what if somebody says, that's a big step to get someone to say, step away from religion or step towards Christianity. Why shouldn't we say, don't choose that Islam, choose this Islam? Put out a different variation of what it means to be a Muslim.
But you're still, even if you go to an individual and say, I think you are practicing that Islam, I think you should move away from that Islam and move away to that Islam. You're still putting yourself in a position of authority where you're telling someone to pick and choose from his or her own religion. That's not what I am about. What I am about is to engage the Muslim in the same way that the jihadist is engaging the Muslim. And in my description of how I became a member of the Muslim Brotherhood movement, I considered myself an akhwan, a brotherhood, a brother, a sister at the time in 1985. I described that process in Infidel. A young woman who looks like us, who's our Islamic religious teacher, comes into our class and she asks us to put up our hands if we are Muslim. And we think that's funny. All of us, 15-year-olds, we chose the Islamic religious education class, IRE. That, by definition, means you're a Muslim. What a funny question. And the next question she asked was, but what about you? Look at yourselves, look at you and look at the others. What about you is really Muslim? And the more questions she asked, the more puzzled and the more curious we became. And her questions led to, if you're truly a Muslim, you don't look it. When was the last time you prayed? I don't know. I didn't remember it. Did you finish fasting? No. Have you got Christian friends? Yes. So what distinguishes you from them? And that was the funny question. Nothing. We played together. We learned together. We lived together. Pretty much nothing distinguished us. And her point was, to be a Muslim, you need to be different. And she was persuasive. She was charming. She was charismatic. She was peaceful. That kind of a figure in a community of young people, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds. And we are not offering an alternative message to that demography, to that telling them, but why are you different? Why are you distancing yourself from the others? What makes you an American? Who are you loyal to? Is the Quran really the Constitution? Is it higher? Is it superior to the Constitution? Have you even read it? You know, that's the sort of engagement that I'm talking about. And it's going to be ultimately the individual who's going to decide from that tray of ideas which one he or she is going to take. My point is, they're now only getting one flavor of morality and moral resources and moral sources.
So if it's an academic argument, why is it that you enlist a priest in Rome when you're having dinner saying, I think the church should be more involved in this?
Because the churches represent a different flavor of morality. Because feminists represent a different form of morality. Because humanists represent a different form of morality. I'm saying the Muslim mind right now is being engaged, it's being sought after by the Islamists. They're being told, this is your religion, this is your civilization, Islam is under siege. And they're being told this over and over and over again. Unfortunately, not all of them are buying into this idea. Fortunately, many of them are rejecting these ideas. But unfortunately, a small group of them are buying it. And when they buy into it, they can become very dangerous. I think what civil society can do is go in, whether it's the churches or feminists or humanists or Quakers or Southern Baptists. I don't give two hoots about who goes in there, but just go in there and give them a different flavor so that at least you start a dissonance within the Muslim mind. When the next imam shows up, charismatic as he is, that think of me as that 15-year-old girl. If I had had other ideas about morality, I could have thrown a counter question to my teacher and said, well, perhaps it's completely out of fashion to pray. Or perhaps it's really not such a bad idea to have a Christian friend. We get along. I don't think God would be against that. I could have started a conversation like that, but my mind wasn't armed that way. And that's what I'm talking about in Nomad.
In the book, you also talk a lot about your family, your father, your mother, your grandmother, your siblings, and their role in helping you along this journey. And one of the things that was interesting to me is your father, who was a clan leader, says, I don't see a role for genital mutilation, but your grandmother insists it must be done. Yeah. Your father says, let him go to school. Your mother's more concerned with, is it a proper Islamic school? Why do you think it was the women who were so focused on the things that people might have thought they should be fighting against?
Because these are women who learned how to survive in the system and were trying to teach us the skills and giving us instruments to survive within the system. My grandmother didn't think that she was genitally mutilating me. She was thinking she was purifying me, knowing that in the Somali context, if you are not, from her perspective, if you are not purified, you will not find a husband. So my grandmother was looking way into the future and very long time thinking, these children will not find husbands unless I carry out this procedure. And nobody told her at that time that perhaps I wouldn't even want a husband who wanted me purified. And that perhaps in the future, it's even possible, and I hope it is possible, that men stand up to this and say, we don't want hymens. We want women, we want human beings, we want a partner, we want a friendship. I don't care whether she's a virgin or not. When men organize and say, we don't want that, things could change. But in my grandmother's context, she didn't know. She thought she was doing the right thing. And if only my father had engaged her in conversation and told her, that is no longer useful. But no one, my father respected her. My mother not only respected her, but was terrified of her. My grandmother just, you know, lived according to the way she and her mother and her forefathers lived in her context. And that's what's wrong with the way we are dealing with Islam today is by exempting it from scrutiny, we're treating it the way my family treated my grandmother. We're not questioning the principles. We're not questioning the habits, the customs. We're not questioning the moral framework that underpins it. We continue to condemn the terrorist acts afterwards, and we write profile after profile after profile of the perpetrators, but that's not enough. And we start looking for psychological explanations like foreclosures and, you know.
A couple of quick questions about you before we open it up to the audience. Imagine you had gotten on the plane in Germany and gone to Canada, sort of a lost, sideways life. Who do you think you would have become? Who would you be right now?
That's the chapter on my half-sister in Norman. And I think I would have gone to Canada and I would have lived somewhere in the projects. It's hypothetical, but it's the question I ask myself when I go and see my father in hospital and he is on his deathbed and I get that pang of regret. What if I hadn't left? What if I was just obedient and did what he told me to do? And then I interact with my sister and I just think this is exactly how I would have been. She lives in Tower Hamlets, 26 years old, has a baby, had another one on the way, English, was very poor, had no job, and what she wanted for herself and the way she lived, huge discrepancy. She said, I want to study law, I want to study psychology, etc. But for her to even get to that point is a long way away. But she's covered from head to toe in the jilbab. And given that context, I thought, my goodness, if I hadn't taken that train, I would have been exactly like her. And I personally would have been unhappy. My sister told me that she was happy with the choices she made. And that makes the word happy relative.
People who know your story know that your choices came at great cost. You have to travel with bodyguards. You've got to be mindful of things all the time. And some people might wonder, why not have gone to Holland, live the life you wanted to live, but do it quietly? What made you decide you wanted to live this public life?
Well, there is when. What makes you want it? It wasn't. First of all, it wasn't planned. And in hindsight, I might have planned it differently. But when it was the 11th of September, and I think that shocked all of you, but in Holland, when I had the first two or three publications, and there was just an almost, I don't want to say an uprising, but there was a huge angry reaction to those publications from Muslims denying that these things happened, that women were treated the way that they were treated. And they were mainly Muslim organizations, spokespeople for Muslim parties and Muslim organizations. I thought, wow, how hard it must be for the woman like me in her teens or in her 20s who wants to get out of that lifestyle. She has to deal with not only her father and mother and her family context, but also with these Muslim organizations. And I felt an obligation to continue publishing and speaking out. And the more I publish, the more questions I get. And then you publish answers to the questions, book length. And it's kind of become my career. But I also find it interesting. I find it rewarding. I think it is, we live in a time when this conflict between Islam and the West is defining, and I'm glad that I'm a part of it in a way that I can contribute to it, having lived in both places. So I don't feel like my freedom has been taken away, and within the context of my protection, I can do much of what you can do and what everyone else can do.
You talk in the book about your youth and being very tied to Islam, and your later years now when you say you're an atheist, and that sort of stood out to me, that you didn't say agnostic, God, but not that God, but no God. And I wondered about that journey.
that journey is also fully explained in Infidel. I found it more plausible to accept the assertion that it is man who made God than God who made man. And I'm not agnostic about that. That's a very small group, which means... Thank you all. But I'm not. I think that I find more persuasive that man made God instead of God made man. But I'm not hostile to God. I'm not hostile to religion. And I see the difference between different religions. And that's why I appeal to Christians and say, look, given the fact that you have a different concept of a God, and given the fact that there are Muslims who are unhappy with Islam, Muslim readers of Infidel who wrote to me asked me the exact same question. They said, I was dissatisfied with Islam just like you are. I left it, but I cannot live without a God. I just can't contemplate being an atheist, so I've converted to Christianity. And I thought, that's great. And then they tell me about Jesus Christ and invite me to come and accept the teachings of Jesus Christ. But what they say of Jesus Christ seems to me to be peaceful. And one thing that no one can deny here, even those people who believe that they are extremist Christians, is the killing of people if you choose an exit option. So if I were born a Christian and I became an atheist, I don't think in the 21st century I'd be killed for becoming an atheist. I might be condemned for it, I might be disapproved of, I might be shunned for it in Orthodox families, but I don't think I would be killed. And I think the same applies to Orthodox Jewish families. If you leave the faith, you'll be disapproved of, but I don't think you'll be killed. And this is what is unique in Islam, is getting out is, it's either you stay in, or if you get out, you die. And that's a compelling argument. Just think of it. If you disagree with me, I'll kill you.
Well, that completes my getting to ask her some questions. It is now your turn to get to ask some questions. We've got people coming down the aisles with microphones. First hand I saw up, David, would you like to ask a question? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being with us. In light of your observations about Islam and your experience as a member of Parliament, what advice would you give President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Oh, wow. Stay friends. I think you're probably responding to the flotilla that washed up in Gaza from Turkey. I think that it's crucial that Israel and the United States remain friends. Israel, I consider to be a part of Western civilization. And I think that given the fact that but that's because I accept the thesis of Samuel Huntington that there is indeed a clash of civilizations. And some of them can collaborate and some of them can conflict, but that most of the others are defining themselves against the West. I think that it's crucial that the West remains united. And by the West, I mean Israel, yes, America, Europe, and the satellites, Canada, Australia, and then some of their former colonies. But that unity is crucial, and, you know, once you get divided, it's easy to be played up against the other. So I would say remain friends, come what may, and disagree behind closed doors, but remain friends.
You've identified yourself with John Stuart Mill and Voltaire. The funny thing is that the liberals don't think too much of you. The New York Times has published about three or four things, the New York Review of Books, The Nation. Somebody said you're pretty, but you're empty-headed. I'm sort of paraphrasing. It was Timothy Garth Ash. And so what's the explanation? Well, one explanation that was given, and I like your comment on it, about Paul Berman, as because of terrorism, liberals have become yellow or cowards. What's your explanation of this, not only on you, but other people who have your kind of ideas have been really smashed or trashed? What's your explanation for that?
Well, some of the criticism I've been getting from liberals is genuine. And I think that there are matters that we disagree on. And we need to have further debates. And there needs to be more data and more evidence. Some of it is probably because I'm hostile to multiculturalism. And I explain why I'm hostile to it. Because it argues that within a liberal society, minorities can sometimes submit members of the minority to practices and habits that the majority of the rest of society is not subjected to. Take, for instance, forced marriages. If my father were to force me into marriage in a Muslim community in the United States, he would argue culture, and many liberals would accept that argument as plausible. Well, I would think that I'm being denied my rights because my white American friend's father can't do the same thing, and he won't get away. She's protected by the law. So there are questions like that, and issues like that, that some of the liberals do not like, or some of the people who call themselves liberal, by the way, because I don't think that's what liberalism was about. And Paul Berman, thinker, intellectual American, says that it's probably because liberals are also afraid. They don't want to live with bodyguards, and they don't want to live with protection, and that they think that this is one way of appeasing them. Christopher Hitchens tries to explain, for instance, Timothy Garton Ash and Ian Buruma's taking the side of Tariq Ramadan. And his analysis is both of them were experts in, you know, the implosion of communist the Soviet Union, and they believe that if you ally with authentic, believing communists and use them to bring the system to implode, that is a preferable way to confronting them and start talking about the different values. And he also explains why they are wrong. Because, you know, you always put yourself on one level higher if you think that you can manipulate one person into accepting your ideas. I would rather not manipulate, I'd rather persuade.
Yeah. All right. This lady. Well, I'm sorry, your hand, I didn't see your hand up.
Thank you. I can consider myself a liberal, and I don't think you're an airhead, by the way. But you mentioned earlier in your discussion about oil money, and I know you're a philosopher, and I appreciate what you're having to say, but I think you're also a politician. And you mentioned Saudi Arabia, I believe, or a Saudi way of approaching things. Could you talk a little bit about the politics of America's relationship with Saudi Arabia and what they're trying to do with their, it appears from at least my naive point of view, that they're trying to play it both ways in the world. And it seems to be causing a lot of problems. Could you comment on that?
I'm commenting on it, not as a politician, not as a philosopher. It's just my opinion, which is Saudi Arabia is not a friend of America. In fact, if there is an enemy of America, it's Saudi Arabia. And if they were to have the military force to show their true colors, they would. But they don't. They are not a military force. The economy is only made up of oil and money that they gain from oil. And they spread their influence across the world. And what they spread, the jihadist or Wahhabi message, is reactionary, it is anti-innovation, it is trying to live according to the dictates of the 7th century as they themselves aspire to live. But a great part of it is also anti-American. All this idea about America being the big Satan, Israel being the small Satan, Islam being under siege, all of that, these ideas, the infidel, and demonizing the infidel, This comes from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia financed and have continually financed for years such outfits as the Muslim Brotherhood and Jama'at al-Islami and these Islamist organizations in Pakistan. For a long time, they've also been financing members of Al-Qaeda. The United States forced them by following the money tracks to stop the government from financing them overtly. But they do it covertly. They say, oh, it's not the government that's doing it, but it's some wealthy prince. And these various princes, I don't know how you can disentangle them, but then they claim that that is an individual who is passing on the money to them. So Saudi Arabia is absolutely not a friend of the United States. We do depend on oil from Saudi Arabia, and I think that is why there is a great deal of support for some alternative way of acquiring energy, whether it is through gas or through offshore drilling or some alternative way, some other way of getting gas. And I think that once we succeed in that, I completely agree with people who say, let's get our energy from someplace else, not from countries that hate us. And that was the campaign of both presidential candidates, McCain and Obama. Let's get our oil from countries that do not hate us. Now, once America succeeds in that, Saudi Arabia is going to need someone else to sell its oil to. And according to some analysts, their oil might not even last for the next 50 years or 100 years. And the greatest blessing for the Saudi population is if that oil runs out. Because instead of spending money on spreading hate across the globe, they will use their energy to survive in a desert like Saudi Arabia.
Anybody from that side that I'm not seeing? In the back there, there's a gentleman with his hand up. I'm sorry, actually, there's a guy on that side. I don't want that side to get mad at me, so we'll go there next.
Thank you. And thank you very much. I appreciate your sharing your thoughts. Very provocative. Some of the things you said I agree with. Some I disagree with. And I happen to be a minister, and so I have some ideas about religion myself. One of the things that you said I'm really struggling with, and that seems to be an assertion on your part, that there is no discrimination in Europe towards minority groups. And you said that if there were discrimination, people would leave. I spent 18 years in Europe, and I think I can tell you that there is a fair amount of discrimination towards minority groups among Europeans. But more importantly, I was an interpreter for two Tunisian men in Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba. These are men who fled a repressive regime that persecuted them at home because they were Muslims. They both went to Europe and had an experience of European racism that pushed them to Afghanistan. And so what we have seen is a large number of Muslims who did, in fact, flee Europe because they felt discriminated against. And the people who launched an attack against us did precisely what you said. They left Europe. So I wonder, are you making the case that there is no discrimination against minorities in Europe? Am I understanding you correctly?
I am not making the case that there is no discrimination against minorities. The case I'm making is there is no institutionalized persecution of Muslims in Europe or America. There is institutionalized aid, help, ways the leadership, whether it's in government, in the academic world, in industry, everywhere in Europe, are struggling with how do we assimilate Muslim minorities and Muslim communities and immigrant communities into our society. I'm not denying that there are individuals in Western Europe who do not like foreigners, who do not like Jews, who are homophobic, who are, you know, just don't like people. And that is not something that is unique to Europe or America. That is, prejudice is a universal deficiency. People discriminate against one another. I think my mother was the biggest racist in the world. We came to Kenya and she started calling them names. We were in Saudi Arabia, she called the Arabs names. When we were in Ethiopia, she didn't like them. It's not, what I'm saying is, it is, people are people prefer their own. That's a given. It's not only the white man who does it. The black man does it, the brown man does it, the yellow man does it. Everybody, each of us prefers their own first and foremost. That's not the problem. What I am fighting against is the perception that is being fed with Saudi money that there is a siege on Islam, that there is a special discrimination against Muslims only, that Westerners are out to destroy Islam. That is the message these people are getting. Don't work with them. Don't associate with them. Don't take over their manners and their way of life. Now, on the one hand, you have government policy trying to encourage people to assimilate, in other words, adopt the values of the country that people have fled to and have come to and are seeking opportunity in. That's government policy. On the other hand, you have organizations and movements saying, telling the same people, don't do it. I have translated for people who are on welfare in the Netherlands, and every time they are offered a job, they would say, I can't take that job because my religion doesn't allow me to work in a cafe where alcohol is served. I can't take that job because my religion doesn't allow me to work in a supermarket where pork and alcohol are sold. I can't take that job because there are women who are not dressed according to the religious prescription, to my religious prescriptions. You can't do all of these things. You don't want to take these jobs because of your religion, but every month you come back for a welfare check. And these welfare checks are given, but they are not told, look. And then the person who says, I don't want to work in a cafe because alcohol is served there and it's against my religion, if the social worker giving out the check says, no, you have to work because I'm going to stop your check, you have a job, that person then says, I'm discriminated against. It's that kind of discrimination that I'm describing. I have talked to business people, entrepreneurs, who give affirmative action only to Muslims, Moroccans and Turks, because they have a diversity policy in their companies. But people wouldn't show up for their jobs. They would take a month off. They would have all sorts of religious claims and demands that they wanted to be accommodated. Some of those demands were accommodated, but if all of them were accommodated for all of them, these businesses would go bankrupt. That is not a discrimination. That is a clash of values, and one value system has to give in. And my logic tells me it's the people who fled poor countries in search of a better life, in prospering societies, who then have to shed some of the convictions and habits and practices that in the first place caused that poverty that they have. The argument that your Guantanamo Bay friends make, saying, okay, well, you translated for them and you brought them as an example, and I've had it over and over again. I think it's such a wild leap of the imagination to say, I feel that I've been treated in a way that I don't like, so I will buy a ticket to Afghanistan and join Al-Qaeda. That is a very wild leap. Imagine if every single person in this room, when faced with some form of adversity, joined Al-Qaeda.
Let's see. We have a young, why don't we come, we'll take a couple of questions down here in the front. There's a lady right here.
No,
wait, one second.
Yeah. All right, somebody else here?
Okay.
Hello, first of all, I would like to thank you for spending your precious time for us. And, you know, I'm from Afghanistan and I grew up in an Islamic country. And the things that you mentioned was so interesting about, like, women's freedom and, you know, like, women's virginity. There are things that belongs to culture, not Islam. Like, for example, in Afghanistan, I know women don't have the same opportunity as the men who were going to out work. For example, in my family, my sister go work in a bank. My sister is students, and two of my brothers, they drop off school and they give us opportunity to go and study. The reason that I'm here, the United States, this is my second year in the United States, to just get a better education and go back to Afghanistan and teach them and kind of like to encourage women to, you know, speak out and give, the, you know, take their rights. But there's, I mean, in Islam, there is no thing that they said like, you know, women, men have more rights than women. And my question is, how many times have you read Quran? And which parts hurt that you didn't like it?
The first part? Just the question.
How many times have you read Quran?
And how which many times parts, have you read the Quran?
Yeah, and which parts you didn't like it?
Okay. How many times have you read the Quran and which parts did you... did I like?
I agree with that.
The parts that I didn't like. Okay. I grew up in Somalia, so the first time I read the Quran, I was about 4 or 5 years old, but it was only memorizing it. And from that time until when I came to Holland, I think I've read it numerous times. And in the early years, it was just reading chapter after chapter and just memorizing it. And then later on, I started to read the meaning. And it was only after 9/11 that I actually dared not only read, but try and answer that incredible question that you just asked, which was, what was it about the Quran that I didn't like? That's a grave question. That's such an important question. Thank you so much for it. One verse that I didn't like at all was the verse that went, it is chapter 4, verse 34. Men are the maintainers and protectors of women. Those women from whom you fear misconduct, warn them, leave them alone in their beds, and beat them. When I read that word, beat them, I was shocked. I didn't want to read it. I didn't want to believe it. I was just like you. I couldn't believe that God was saying that. As an interpreter, translator, I've come across so many women who are battered and who couldn't come out of it because their husbands were using that verse as a justification to beat them. Now, domestic violence occurs in Holland among people who are not Muslim at all. And men who beat their wives, part of the punishment is that they're sent to clinics that are called anger management, where they can learn not to beat but to talk. And the Muslim men wouldn't go because they said, God has given, I'm not insane, I don't need to go to a clinic. She disobeyed me, I won't touch her. If she obeys me, I'll beat her only when she disobeys me. And the imam agreed. And worse, her parents agreed. The whole clan agreed. Now there's another verse. Chapter 2, verse 222. I wonder if you're going to remain a Muslim at the end of this session. Women are as a tilth unto you. Come unto your tilth when and whenever you like. That verse is used as an excuse to rape women, wives, because they are as a tilth unto you. And it's an opportunity that's not given to men. And in your country, in Afghanistan, there was a report of women who demonstrated. They demonstrated and against the mullahs, and the vice and virtue police went after them and started hitting them on their ankles. It was reported in the New York Times. And one of the things that they were protesting against and they were citing was rape within the marriage. And the rapists were using these verses. Now consider the fact that many, probably most, Muslim marriages are arranged. And sometimes you can be lucky. And your father and your mother can find a husband for you whom you really like. But very often that's not the case. Now imagine a man forcing himself on you, waving that Quranic verse and saying, it's my right to come unto you whenever I like. And I can go on and on. I don't want to bore the audience, but there are many more. I don't like it. Please watch the film Submission. It's online. Well, there's the one that says, veil yourself. There is the one, women have to veil themselves. And then there is the abhorrent one of flogging. You come from a country where the Taliban actually flog and stone women. Flog, that is chapter 24, verse 2. Flog the adulterer and the adulteress 100 times. Do it in the companion of witnesses, and let no compassion move you. And that is done today in the 21st century. Distance yourself from the infidels. I mean, I can go on and on, but there are more, but these are just the three that I think are quite impressive. Yeah.
All right. I think we're getting down to the last question we had pointed you out.
I just want to say how happy I am to meet you. From the time I read your book, it was such a compelling education. I've read so many books, but the way Infidel was, I think, for so many people, it educated us in an emotional way about things in another world that many of us never knew about or understood. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And I have followed your journey. And as a role model for women, and for me, you're an exceptional role model. And I have followed your journey and interested in, I've been reading a lot about Geert Wilders. And in the New York Times this week, there was the article about Jeb Cohen and the election with Geert Wilders. And I'm just curious as to how you're feeling about these two opponents and where you come out on their philosophies and what's going on right now in Holland.
This is going to be a class in Dutch politics. As I'll be very short. We have a list system. We don't have a two-party system as you have in the United States. And political parties have lists of candidates. So we don't have districts. You don't have to campaign for yourself. You campaign for the party. But the party decides, where and they put you on the list. Job Cohen heads the list of the Social Democratic Party, and Geert Wilders heads the list of what he calls the Freedom Party that he himself founded. Their main bone of contention is Islam in the Netherlands. Job Cohen comes out on the side of it's perhaps best if we give Muslim minorities as much leeway as we possibly can, that we accommodate as many demands as is possible within a free society, and hope that evolution, that they will evolve, and that's going to take generations. Job Cohen's party has come to depend on the vote of the Muslim minorities in the Netherlands that are almost majorities in the four large cities. And the four large cities are very important. I mean, Holland is a very small place. Amsterdam, Utrecht, Den Haag, and Rotterdam are very, very important. And that is where the Muslim minorities are almost majorities in these places. Geert Wilders says they have to assimilate completely and unequivocally, and only then are they members of this society. Otherwise, he has all kinds of policies that I don't agree with and that I think appall Job Cohen and his followers. Regardless of me disagreeing with Geert Wilders on his policies, a huge number of Dutch people agree with it and might vote for him. My vote doesn't go with Job Cohen because I don't agree with appeasement or accommodation. I think it has to be a balance between that. And traditionally, the only way to really bring about a viable long-term policy in the Netherlands is to have the established parties, that is Job Cohen's party, the Social Democrats, that is the Liberal Party, of which Geert Wilders has divorced himself, that is the Christian Democratic Party. Those three parties, if they were to sit together, because those three parties usually have a majority of votes, sit together and solve this problem and come up with policies that really work, and they've been written down in all kinds of policy papers, I think they could use the patients, that the Dutch population, the Dutch electorate would bring up the patients to say, okay, we will wait for these policies to work out. That's where I would be seeking answers and not Geert Wilders's, you know, let's deport, let's ban the Quran, shoot people in the knees.
All right. Well, okay, we have a author prerogative question. The young lady over here, please ask your question.
Well, thank you very much.
I didn't want you to say I overlooked you.
I wouldn't. Actually, I'm not here for a how-to guide or anything like that at all. It's actually a very big deal for me to be here. Wow, I'm very sorry. And I'll try to be as concise as possible. I actually have an article right here that I wrote in support of you some years ago. And also an article, the article I cited and a couple of interviews I cited where you talked about genuine reformers. And then you talked about hope coming from two of five groups of Muslims. The first being people who have left and the second being genuine reformers who accept what that is which is constructive and reject that which is not. I came out doing so very publicly several years ago to the very predictable response of death threats, rape threats, threats of acid in my face, threats of my breast being chopped off, threats of all kinds of fun things. And even during short hiatuses of that, pictures of me ending up on porn sites that are not even pornographic pictures of me, emails to my friends, and utter lack of response from authorities, et cetera. And sometimes I feel like giving up. And I know that I can't. And I know that I can't when I get emails from young women who say that they want to hate me, but they agree, and this is what their father did to them, this is what their uncle did to them, and please don't ever shut up, and all of those things. I've had the blessing of speaking publicly many times, and that part's been great. But my question is, you've spoken about what people like pastors should do, what Christians should do, what non-religious people should do. What advice would you have for somebody like me?
My goodness, yeah. Stay alive. Yeah. Thank you so much for your question, because it demonstrates to the public, and I had no idea. I was expecting a challenging question telling me that I was traumatized and that I was attacking Islam, etc. So, thank you so much for your question, because you belong to the group of young women who write emails to me saying exactly what you said, sharing your pain, sharing the challenges that you face. Please stay alive. Please don't forget to lead your life. I mean, I don't know if you're in school. I don't know what your job is. I don't know how where your income comes from. I don't know how much time you have for activism. And then that amount of time that you have for activism, what can I advise you to do? To say, make friends, create a network, expand that network, and you can do that openly. I'm doing it openly, but then I live with protection. Or you can do it under the radar, and the AHA Foundation, and you're giving me an opportunity to talk about my foundation. It caters to people like you, where we can work together. It's the Ayaan Hirsi Ali Foundation. It's been established in 2008. We have a board now, and our mission statement is to combat, to fight for the rights of women, to fight for the rights of women against militant Islam and tribal custom. Join us. It is theahafoundation.org. Don't forget the THE, theahafoundation.org. And please work with us. Let's stay in touch. And thank you so much for this. Yeah. No, thank you.
My thanks to all of you who asked questions, those who wanted to ask questions. Ayaan now is going to go out and sign books. It'll be an opportunity for you to at least have a moment with her. So hopefully, I think you're going to have a long line, Ayaan. Yeah. The night's going to continue. Yeah. And thank you for coming out tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.